nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so I want to say a few words about this. You're all preparing for a career of one sort or another, right? Most of you will probably end up going into industry. A few of you have your heart set in academia, but we're all involved in this field of semiconductor technology. And I want to share a few thoughts on becoming a true technology developer. Remember, this is free advice, so you can take it for what it's worth. So what is a true technology developer? Well, you know, if you really want to contribute to this field, you have to have a very broad understanding. You have to understand physics, because you don't know what problems you might be working on 30 years from now in your career. And chemistry. Maybe we need to add biology to that these days. People are saying we should make that a requirement. But you have to understand materials. A lot of electronic device technology these days is materials technology. Not just the semiconductor, but the high-k gate dielectrics, the metallization, the low-k gate low-k dielectrics with a metallization stack. So it's important to understand something about materials. You need to understand devices. That's what this course is all about. But also circuits and systems. Now, obviously, each of you has an area of interest or focus. Some of you know a lot more about circuits and systems than you do about devices and materials. Some of you know a lot more about physics and devices than you do about circuits and systems. But if you want to work in this field, you should try to get a broad understanding of everything so you can talk to people you're going to be working with on your teams. You need to understand theory. You need to understand experiments and how they're done. Metrology, or measuring things. How do you measure things? How accurately can you measure them? How much uncertainty is there in them? Characterization, how do you go in the lab and do the measurements and characterize the performance? How do designers work? What do they think about? What's important to them? So if you're an experimentalist, you need to understand how to talk to the theorists. The best experimentalists do their own theory. If you're doing theory, you can't possibly do very relevant theory, except for a few exceptions, unless you understand how people build things and what the uncertainties are and what the limitations are. If you're designing some new technology, you have to understand how designers work with new technologies, what the constraints are, what their issues are. You should get a good feel for typical numbers. Now, I've kind of tried to emphasize in this course that when you compute the velocity in the channel of the MOSFET, if it's higher than the speed of light, bells should go off and you should say, wait a minute here, you know, I better go back and check my calculation. Some of you are doing that now when I graded the exams. I'm glad to see that. But even more than that, you know, whenever you work on a new problem, you want to get calibrated to what are some typical numbers. You know, what's a typical on current? What's a typical gate oxide thickness these days? What's a typical power supply voltage? Unless you have some feel for the typical numbers, it's hard to work. It's hard to test your results. It's hard to sit around the table with a team and have some ideas and bat them around unless you have some feeling for what the numbers are. So a lot of people, when they enter a field for the first time, they try to get themselves calibrated. You know, what are some numbers that I need to know? How many know what the back of the envelope is? Is this an old, this is dating me, you know? You used to do calculations, you know, you take an old envelope that had been used and turn it over and do some quick calculation on it. You need to be able to sit down and just do some quick numbers and see, does it make sense? Does it make sense for me to spend the next 2 or 3 years of my life working on a thesis and doing all of the details? You know, does it make sense for me to propose this idea to my company? You need to be able to do some quick numbers that sort of say, okay, this looks reasonable, this might work, and then you need to be capable of filling in the details, meaning solving the differential equations, you know, working with the CAD program or whatever it is, doing all of the details when you have to. And one of the things I'm going to mention is that when these computer-aided programs start spitting out numbers, you have to be able to get out your back of the envelope and jot down some quick numbers and say, do these make sense? You know, do I understand what's coming out of them? It's very useful to appreciate that if you're in engineering, it's not just about doing things because it's neat technology. You know, the companies have to make a profit. You have to understand the constraints of the marketplace. You know, now, how do you pick up all of these things? You know, it's, you know, one, you're really lucky to be in an environment where there are speakers all the time, you know, seminar speakers. Some of the most successful students I've seen come out of here, you know, I noticed they were in all of those seminars, even if it was totally unrelated to their field. They'd sit in and they'd pick up a little bit. They'd learn something about some topic they'd never be exposed to otherwise. Maybe the talk isn't that good, but at least in the first 5 or 10 minutes, you'll get some introduction and you'll know, okay, I know that what that field is about. And I'm going to, what I'm going to talk about today for, you know, just 15 or 20 minutes is using computer simulations as a fact of life in modern engineering. And I love this phrase that I came across. A good engineer knows how to stand up to a computer. You know, the engineers that aren't so good just let the computer spit out numbers and assume it must be right. And then bridges fall down and things, right? So you really have to be very careful about using. It's a fact of life. You have to use them. They can make you tremendously productive, but you have to know how to use them. So that's what I'm going to say. We've been using a little bit of it in class, and you know, not in a very, I think it's been a helpful way for the class. You've seen some of the limitations of the simulation, but if you do this, you know, when your company's future depends on it, you want to do it much more seriously. So, you know, it's a fact of life. You can't live without these programs these days. You're going to, whatever field you go into, you're going to be dealing with really sophisticated computer simulations. They're absolutely essential, but they can really become a crutch. Some people stop thinking, well, I'll just run the program and it'll spit out the answer. You have to be on guard for that so that that doesn't happen. If you use it right, it can make you a much better engineer. But if you quit thinking and just push the button and run another simulation, it can be a real problem. All of these programs have limitations. Some of them have errors, especially if you're working on research codes that, you know, that aren't well-developed commercial packages. But even the commercial packages can have errors in them. It's a fact of life, you know. You have to use these programs. You know, you can't say, well, this shouldn't have happened. It's not my fault. You know, you're going to have to deal with it. So I have a few. I came across a few over the years, a few people who have spoken on this subject that I thought had very wise things to say. This fellow, Ron Roher, I think is very well known. He's one of the pioneers in circuit and VLSI design, did a lot of really good work. And he wrote an article called Taking Circuits Seriously. And he was part of the generation that developed programs like SPICE, you know, and that made that part of the CAD community. And he thought that this was going to be so wonderful in education because you would relieve students of all of this tedium of writing down these loop and node equations and solving all of this, you know, and you would just be able to develop, you'd be relieved of all of that tedium and you could develop insight and understanding just by seeing what the answer was. But then he had second thoughts about it. You know, what he said is, many members of the SPICE generation, so these are people that, like you, SPICE has always been there. You've never had to really do a serious circuit simulation totally by hand with slide rules, right? Merely hack away at design. They guess at circuit values, run a simulation, and then guess at changes before they run a simulation again and again and again. Designers need an ability to create a simple and correct model to describe a complicated situation. That's the back of the envelope. You have to first of all scope out the design, make sure it's, okay, this is roughly what I want. Then you do the simulation to fill in the details. Says the back of the envelope has become the back of the cathode ray tube. That's dating him already. There aren't many cathode ray tubes left, but There aren't many people that do back-of-the-envelope calculations very well. You had to before because you didn't have CAD tools to do it. And he says, intuition has gone on vacation. So my advice is don't become a spice monkey. Did I mention this earlier in the class? Sometimes I had a group of recruiters come. They were looking for people to do spice simulations. But they said, we don't want any spice monkeys. Spice monkeys are people that don't think about what they're doing. They just push the button, run. That didn't work. Change this parameter. Push the button, run. You know, don't be a spice monkey or a Medici monkey or a Taurus monkey or a Supreme monkey or whatever you're doing. This fellow Petrowski, he writes a column every month in American Scientist. He's a civil engineer. So, I mean, this is all fields of engineering have the same problems. And he points out that all of these tools begin with some assumptions, therefore they have limitations. You know, they're not, you know, the people who sell these programs don't prominently advertise the limitations. They're more interested in promoting the features. But actually, they may not even know the limitations. Right? You know, they're only human. These are complicated programs. They may not know where the limits are, when the program will give unrealistic results. And then people that really aren't careful about using them can get themselves into even more trouble. So here's another. This is also an excellent book. Too bad it's out of print. But some more thoughts about just in general on using simulation programs. And this fellow, Eugene Ferguson, points out that if you're using the program, it's very, very hard for you to know what assumptions the programmer made. These are really long programs that have been developed by teams of people over 20 or 30 years. You know, the person currently working on it now doesn't even know who the people were who started it, doesn't know what they did for sure. So there really is no one person that really knows everything in the code. You can't totally document it. All right? It would take volumes and volumes, and nobody would be able to find what you're looking at. So you're going to run these, and it's going to be very difficult for you to know what assumptions are buried in there. You may be able to find some of them. But that means if you use them, you have to say, well, I assume it must be true. They charge me a lot of money for this program. People have been using it for a long time. It must be right. There are a lot of people that make that assumption. Or you can constantly be on guard, be able to check the results. Do a back-of-the-envelope calculation. Say, is this what I expected to see? Does this make sense? If I change this parameter, something should happen. When I do that, does it happen? So it's really up to the person who's using the program. You can't expect that the person who wrote it will fully understand the problem that you're applying it to. It may have been a little different. It may be much different than the one he had in mind and he or she had in mind when they wrote the program. And that's because there are two different kinds of people in the world. There are people that build things, circuits, devices, processes. And there are people that like to analyze things. They like to do theory and solve problems. The analysts are the people who write these computer programs. Very challenging to do, takes very sophisticated numerical techniques, takes specialists who work a long time to do that. Now, this is kind of interesting. This was quoted in this book by Ferguson. He quoted a Canadian structural engineer. They were studying why a bridge fell down. And unfortunately, part of it had to do with the CAD program. But you know, he points out that because, you know, this is civil engineering, but it applies to us too. He says, because these programs are so complex, the entire profession is going to use CAD tools that are written by a very few number of people. There are only a few people that can do it, and there are only a few teams that get around to doing this. Those few will come from the ranks of the analysts, people who like to analyze problems and do theory and solve equations. They won't come from the people who build things and who really understand that the problems are, the equations are some simple model. They contain assumptions. They can never be as complex as the real thing. The person doing that can never fully understand all of the factors that go into some real technology because they haven't had 10, 20, 30 years experience accumulating all of that. So their experience on those just has to be limited. And it's really hard to see how they could have all of the experience of a builder as acquired over a career and still be an expert and acquired all of the expertise and things they have in doing analysis and computer simulation. So what that means is that designers have to use these programs, but they have to be aware of their limitations, and they have to be able to stand up to and reject or modify the results of an analysis. Because for this particular problem, it was limited, it didn't include some important factor. So Ferguson concludes by saying the engineers who can stand up to a computer will be those who understand this, that software incorporates many assumptions that cannot be easily detected, but which affect the results. There are 1,000 points of doubt in every complex computer program. So successful computer-aided design requires vigilance and sort of the same kind of attributes that a good technology developer has. You use them when you're using programs. So this phrase here came from a colleague of mine who works at National Semiconductor, and he wrote a paper on process and device simulation, a technology developer's view. And he's talking about people who use programs to simulate semiconductor processes and semiconductor devices. So that's our field. And he pointed out the basic difference between an ordinary TCAD user, that's technology CAD, and a true technology designer is that the former is relaxed, accepting unfazed the program's results. The latter is concerned and busy checking them in sufficient depth to satisfy him or herself that the software developer did not make dangerous assumptions. And this isn't easy to do, right? You're not going to get it in this class. You're not going to get it while you're at Purdue, right? You know, maybe I can sensitize you to it. It's something you ought to, it's a skill you ought to think about acquiring over a period of time with experience. He says it takes years of training in good schools, followed by hands-on design practice to develop this capability. It cannot be acquired with short courses or miracle push-button simulation tools that absolve the engineer of understanding in detail what he is doing. And he sent me a picture of a colleague of his at National who, this guy apparently is a very famous analog circuit designer. I'm not sure, he may be retired now, but his computer gave him a result that he knew he couldn't believe. So he took it out on his computer. But yeah, he relies on CAD, but he knows when to use it. You know, he knows he's in charge, right? If the circuit doesn't work, it's because it was an error on his part. It isn't because it was an error on the computer program's part. So he went up to the top of the roof and threw the computer off. Okay, so I'll just give you a few tips on how one should use a simulation tool. First of all, you should try to understand what this thing is doing. What equations is it solving? It's helpful to know a little bit about what numerical methods it is, because that might tell you something about placing nodes or other convergence or other things you have to be worried about. There are also physical models. Maybe you solve the semiconductor equations, but where does your mobility come from? You know, where does the recombination rate come from? Where does the impact ionization rates come from? Do they come from experimental data? Is there some model? Usually in most of these programs, you have dozens of different options that you can choose, and it's your responsibility to pick the one that is the best. You know, it's always good to try a really, an almost trivial problem first and see if you get an answer that you expect. Because many of these tools, it's difficult to run. They may be perfectly correct. You run them, and somehow you've set something up wrong, and it's doing what you told it to do, but not what you meant it to do. So run something trivial and see if you get the right answer. You may be able to find examples that other people have done and they've used for a while that can get you started. These programs have a lot of default settings, and you can never assume that they are chosen to give you the best answer. They're just defaults. And you have to know what the defaults are because if you choose not to override them, you need to know what it's doing. And it's not cheating to ask somebody who's used this before for some help. That's why you develop a network. That's really useful. So I'm just, this was the last homework assignment you had, and the solution is posted. So I'd like you to go through the solution to see how I thought about it. I think I figured out what was being plotted in there. But basically, if you look at what I did, I just went through and I said, okay, I look at that result. Gauss's law has to hold. I also have a plot of electric field somewhere else. So I ought to be able to get that point by going back to the electric field and taking Gauss's law, things like that. If you understand physics and you understand devices, you can check the results to make sure that they're reasonable. So here's a simple tool on the NanoHub. Just does PN junctions. It's got an industrial strength CAD tool underneath it, but it's been simplified so that we don't ask students to worry about all of those details. One of the things that we need to do, and I'm going to try to work with the developers to see that we do this better, is to do a little better about explaining what equations this tool solves so that people know. It'll tell you it's using a program called Padre, and you can find the user's manual on Padre. It's big and thick. But there are a few things that we could specify and should much more carefully. But what it does is it provides an exact solution to the semiconductor equations. Right? There are three semiconductor equations. Poisson's equation for the electric potential in terms of the two carrier densities, and two continuity equations, and then we use drift diffusion equations for the currents that relate the electron density and gradient and the hole density and gradient to the currents. If you solve those three equations together, you get the answer. You spend a lot of time in 305 and 606 simplifying these equations with depletion approximations and low-level injection and things like this so that you can get analytical solutions. It just takes these equations, discretizes them on a grid, and gives you the answer. So you don't have to do that. It's simplified. You just have a uniformly doped P region. You have a uniformly doped N region. It allows you to put an intrinsic region inside. The junctions are abrupt, you know, highly simplified. You always want to know not only what equations are being solved, but what are the boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions in this case are ideal ohmic contacts. You know, there is no such thing in practice, but it's a mathematical idealization. It means there's no extra resistance. The property of an ideal ohmic contact is it forces the carrier densities to their equilibrium values all the time. So it's like a surface recombination velocity that's infinite. Now, there are some things that I don't know what it does, that I could probably run a few simulations and get a pretty good guess as to what it's doing, but we should try to document it. Like, what does it do for recombination? It allows you to feed in lifetimes. So that suggests that it's treating Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination. Is the flag for Auger recombination turned on or off? Is the flag for radiative band-to-band recombination turned on or off? I don't know. I could think of a few tests I could do to try to see, but we should try to document. How about the mobility? It doesn't ask you to input a mobility. It must have built-in models that it thinks are reasonable models for the field, electric field, and doping-dependent mobility in silicon. So that's what we're solving. All right, so whoops, we hit the button on the default simulation, we get a result. This is a band diagram. So if I look at this black arrow there, that looks like the built-in potential across the junction. Now, let me check that. I can just read the numbers off of that. It's 0.83 volts. Right, that ought to be something I could easily check. I know there's a simple expression for the built-in potential of the PN junction. The default doping was 10 to the 17th on each side. Ni is about 10 to the 10th. Yeah. So plug numbers in, we get 0.84 volts. Probably close enough. Maybe room temperature isn't exactly 300 K. They probably have a temperature-dependent Ni model that doesn't make Ni exactly 1.00 times 10 to the 10th. All right, we're probably close enough. So that looks good. Here are the equilibrium carrier densities. This is a PN junction. Purple is This is the P side here on the left. This is the N side on the right. The purple line here is the hole concentration, and the green line is the electron concentration. So if I look at, just read it off the plot, it says that the equilibrium hole density over here is 10 to the 17th. Stoke 10 to the 17th, that sounds reasonable. It says that the equilibrium hole density in the N side is 993 per cubic centimeter. All right, is that right? Well, the minority carrier hole concentration should be Ni squared over Nd. Plug in numbers, that should be 1,000. All right, we probably have a little different Ni squared. All right, everything looks fine. Space charge density. Okay, I know around the p-n junction there should be depletion regions. Okay. This doesn't quite look right. It doesn't look like a depletion, right? Depletion regions are doped. You know, there's a uniform charge, Q, N, D, and then it drops at the depletion region edge, which we assume is abrupt. I don't see any constant region. Well, looks kind of odd. If I were depleted on the P side, I would have a negative charge of minus Q times Na. Plug in numbers, that would be 0.016 coulombs per cubic centimeter. This is 0.01, this is 0.01 minus 0.015. It looks like that peak there is minus Q times Na. I'm just not seeing much of a depletion region. Okay. If I compute a depletion region depth, all right, textbook formula, plug in numbers, it's 0.15. It's a symmetric junction, so half of it is on each side. So that's 0.075. Let's see. This is a half a micron. This is 0.2. That's 0.125. So it's a little, the depletion region edge is right about there. So it looks like I don't really have a clearly defined depletion region. Okay, maybe it's the exact solution. All right. So let me lower the doping density. And see, I know if I lower the doping density, it extends depletion regions. Maybe I can push it out and see whether this thing really is doing the right thing. So lower it by a factor of 100 on each side, push the button. And then this is what I get. Oops, can't see much there. So I change the scale. Ah, that's starting to look like a depletion region. The edge of the depletion region doesn't look so abrupt the way we draw it in textbooks, but it sort of looks like a depletion region. But my p-n junction is at 1 micron, and I've depleted all the way to the contact, and I've depleted all the way to the other contact. Right? Maybe that's going to affect the results, because usually in your p-n junction, you let it deplete, and then there's a bulk semiconductor on each side. So maybe I should make my diode a little longer. So I made it 4 microns. My junction is at 2. I have 2 microns on either side. Now I can see the charge going down to 0 in the neutral semiconductor. That looks more like what it should look like. I compute Q times Na. That's 0.00016. So that's right there. There's my depletion region. You can see that the edge of the depletion region isn't very abrupt, the way we think of it. In fact, if I wanted to see whether this transition region here was reasonable, what would I calculate on the back of my envelope? It's a simple little calculation I could do to tell me if that edge was reasonable. Or maybe I didn't feed in a good enough grid and it's some kind of numerical error. I could find out which it is. How about the extrinsic Debye length? When I get to the edge of the depletion region, there's just a little bit of a perturbation in the potential. Almost all of the potential drop is gone. What's the length that a perturbation in potential is screened out in a semiconductor? It's the Debye length. Right? Depends on the doping density. Plug numbers in, I could check that. So it looks like I have a depletion region there. I could compute the depletion region depth. It's still a symmetrical junction, so I get about 0.44 on each side. And you find the depletion region depth is in this transition region there. All right. So it all looks reasonable. All right, so I could stop and say, okay, I believe the program, let's go. But let's try one more thing. Let me try an asymmetric junction, because I know what should happen here. So instead of doping it 10 to the 15th on both sides, I'll dope it 100 times higher on the P side. This is the old result. So what should happen? It's always nice to change something, and then before you look at the result, to have an idea of what, you know, what do I expect to happen? If you don't see it, then you know it's worth thinking about. So I have 100 times higher doping density here. So I'm not going to deplete much on this side. All of the depletion should be in that side. It's what we call a one-sided junction, right? So let's push the button and see what happens. Here's the energy band diagram, right? Just like you expected. My junction is at 2 microns. Bands are almost flat. I just see a little bit of a dip down on the P side. All of the band bending and depletion is going on the N side, right? Nothing surprising there. Let's look at the space charge density just to see what it looks like. All right, that looks a little odd. Okay, but let me blow it up. All right, I blow it up. Now that still looks odd. So let's see what I have here. My P side is doped 10 to the 17th. So the depleted charge would be negative, and the depleted charge would be minus 0.016 coulombs per square centimeter. Minus 0.016. I don't even have that much charge here. I have 0.003. So this charge is much smaller than the depletion charge. In fact, it's been so heavily doped, you haven't even been able to deplete it at all. So there's some thin region there that it's trying to deplete, but it hasn't even depleted it. Right? There's still a bunch of holes over there. How about the other side? The other side, whoops, this is my N side was doped 10 to the 15th. This is asymmetric. So that's 10 to the 15th. So Q times 10 to the 15th would be 0.00016. Let's see. This is 0.001. So this is 0.0005. That's 0.00016. That's flat region there to the right of the junction is my depletion region. Okay, so I've got a depletion region on the lightly doped side. All right. But what's this? I mean, this is not what the textbooks say. Right. This is a PN junction, asymmetric. I'm supposed to have a depletion region. Okay, on the heavily doped side, I don't see a clear depletion region, but I'm trying to get one. On the P side, I see a depletion, or on the N side, I'm sorry, the lightly doped side, I see a depletion region. I see an edge of the depletion region, which isn't abrupt, but I see a spike. Pardon me? Yeah, so, you know, this is why it's interesting that frequently, when you ask yourself these kind of questions, you see something that looks wrong, and sometimes it's wrong, and sometimes you learn something, right? So I don't think this is in any textbook, but it's something you can find in papers 20 or 30 years ago. It's there, it's real, and if you look at it in the right way, it makes perfect sense. So here are the carrier densities. So the purple line is the hole density. 10 to the 17th on the P side, and then it goes down. It's a minority carrier here on the N side, so it's much lower. here is the electron density on the n side, 10 to the 15th, and then it goes down. So these electrons, they kind of spill over into the other side. The holes spill over towards the right, the electrons spill over towards the left, an electric field gets built up. That's what keeps them from, stops them and makes the depletion region. But if you look very carefully, there are an awful lot of holes on this P plus side. When they spill over, if you look very carefully, the junction is right here at 2 microns. There is this thin region here where the holes that are spilling over swamp the depletion charge. That positive spike on charge is mobile holes that have spilled over from the heavily doped P side. Now, if you look at that on an energy band diagram, it all makes perfect sense. This is the energy band diagram. Right? This is the one we looked at before. It's just what you would have sketched. Nothing mysterious here. Remember that if the Fermi level is above the intrinsic level, we're n-type. So this is our n side of the junction. If the Fermi level is below the intrinsic level, we're p-type. So this is the p side of the junction. If I look right here, just to the right of 2 microns, the Fermi level is below the intrinsic level. I'm on the n side because I'm to the right of 2 microns, but the semiconductor is p-type because its Fermi level is below the intrinsic level. In fact, if you cover up everything from 0 to 2 microns, that energy band diagram would look like something you've seen before in this class. What would it look like? It would sort of look like an MOS capacitor. If I didn't tell you, if I hadn't shown you this, this would look like an N-type semiconductor where you bent the bands up, the surface potential is negative. In fact, you've bent them up so far that you've inverted the surface of the N-type semiconductor to P-type. So it's an inversion layer inside a P-N junction. It's there, it affects the depletion region depths, it affects the electric fields. Goes away very quickly if you have any grating on the junction. But it's something people have worried about what effect it has in PN junction capacitance for a long time. Okay. So sometimes when you check, it's actually interesting. You find something, you learn something. Because we're so used to these depletion approximations and analytical approximations, when you can see the exact solution, sometimes it surprises you. Okay, so there's a lot more to being a true technology developer than running computer simulations, but that's one part of it. And you know, I want to encourage you when you're doing that, and you're going to do a lot of that in your careers, to become one of those people who can stand up to these computers.